Welcome back to InfoTrack and our host, Chris Whitting.
There's a game changer for building long-term wealth, a strategy that can transform your financial future and revolutionize your approach to investing. Here with the details, InfoTrack reporter Roy Mackey. Roy?
Thank you, Chris. Our guest is Charles D. Ellis. He's a highly respected investment consultant who has written a number of books on investing, the latest of which is Rethinking Investing, A Very Short Guide to Very Long-Term Investing. Mr. Ellis, your book is only about 100 pages long. What core message did you want every reader to take away from this?
That there's nothing so wonderful as the power of compounding and time. And if you do have time, our children or grandchildren do have time, it's amazing what they can accomplish if they just stick in there and let compounding do its wonders. 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128. That last part is really wonderful, but you have to start early in order to have that included.
Your book says long-term investing should be viewed over decades, not months or years. How does thinking in, for example, six-decade horizons change the investment decisions at any stage in life?
Well, first of all, it gets you in the right frame of mind that if you have the opportunity to be a long-term investor, that's a huge competitive advantage, and you really ought to exercise it as the whole advantage it is. So move your thinking from what's going on today, this week, this month, or thinking long-term is 6 months and a little longer. Get your thinking going on the real power is that very long-term that each of us has. If you start investing in your mid-20s and you're still investing in your mid-80s, that gives you a frame of reference of 60 years to do compounding. And that's how you get to that sweet spot at the end of the 1-2-4-8 sequence.
Does that mean that long-term basically means that a 50-year-old really isn't investing for himself or herself anymore, but for their descendants? Is that right?
Well, some people are investing only for themselves because, candidly, the amount of savings they have are inadequate to think beyond their own lifetime. And in that case, I can understand people doing something very different. But if you happen to be lucky, and, you know, I have been very, very lucky. I've done work I love doing. It has me deeply involved with investing for years and years and years. I've served on two of the largest endowment funds in the world, investment committees for years. As the saying goes, I've been around. That's the one advantage of being at my age. However, when you think about it, all of us are going to be around for a long time, hopefully. And that's the most competitive advantage anybody could ever have as an investor. Take advantage of it.
You are a fan of index funds. Tell us why you think those are better in most cases for most people.
Well, I'm very data-based. And if you look at the evidence, first of all, when I was young and full of beans, active investing made a lot of sense. You could do much better in the market. That's because 90% of transactions done in the New York Stock Exchange were done by individuals who had no access to research of any kind, made a transaction once every 2 years. Half of those trades were done in telephone common stock. These are very, unfortunately, underinformed individuals, so beating them was not hard. Today, the competition is unbelievable. 90%+ of trading is done by institutions, all with experts. Half of that is done by the 50 largest institutions, almost all hedge funds, and very aggressive, very well-informed. It used to be that you got your major information as an active manager by having private luncheon briefings or dinner briefings with senior executives. Today, that's against the law. Any information that's available to any individual of any publicly listed company has to be made available to all investors. So most every company does an 800-number conference call once a quarter, and that's it. So everybody knows the same thing as everybody else does. Everybody's got internet. And you look at all those different changes, they've completely changed the nature of trading or investing in the world that we live in. So I believe we ought to look and see, does it have any consequence? One of the consequences is 85 to 90% of actively managed mutual funds underperform the benchmark they were aiming for. Now, that is after fees, I recognize, but it's not a matter of incompetence on their part. It's a matter of all the fabulous capability of all the other people that are competing to try to figure out what's the right price. And correct pricing is the ultimate function of any market. this happens to be a market that is superb at getting that right price. So doing better than other people is really, really hard. I believe indexing is the obvious solution. Very low cost. It keeps you from worrying about individual stocks. It protects you from all the things that behavioral economists tell us make mistakes that cost the average investor in the average year 200 basis points or 2% of the return. And if you believe markets return something like 7%, that's a big hit. But overcoming that is really hard. Bypassing it, skipping it, never having anything to do with it because you're in index funds, which are hopefully, candidly, boring, just like it's boring to know all about the plumbing system that we all depend upon in our private homes. It's boring to know about the electrical system that we all depend upon in our homes. It's boring to know about all the details of the railroad schedule that we count on when it works, right? Anything boring keeps us from getting excited, and getting excited is what leads us to making behavioral mistakes, and it's expensive. So skipping the expensive part is terrific, and then low fees is terrific, and then low taxes is terrific. Then you add all those things together, and for individuals and for institutions, indexing makes an enormous amount of sense. The last part is it allows you to concentrate on long-term investment strategy or policy. What will work best for you? And that is where the real payoffs come for anybody who wants to be, quote-unquote, an active investor. Be active on the part that matters. Be active on the part of figuring out who are you, what are you trying to accomplish, what do you have in the way of resources, that sort of thing, and get that down pat. If you get that right, indexing can take care of the implementation for you.
Tell me a little bit about your take on Social Security benefits and a home, for example, as part of a total portfolio. How does that work into your advice?
Most people don't even begin to think about their Social Security benefits until they come to retirement age. But if you look at it, it's candidly one of the best bond equivalents anywhere in the world. The American government is the best credit risk anywhere in the world. And Social Security benefits are increased every year to adjust for inflation. So, you know, that's pretty terrific. If you thought about, hey, nobody's ever made a bond that's that good big deal. But it is the equivalent of a bond. And if you think about your total life portfolio, Social Security benefits and your equity value of your home are both fixed values or semi-fixed values. They increase with inflation, but they don't go any higher. If anybody could think about including that in their total portfolio, all of their assets, they would be so well advised to think that's the bond equivalent. I've already got an enormous fraction of my total resources in bond equivalents. Why do I want to have bonds in my security portfolio, which is the one place where I can take long-term investment in equities as an alternative? My view, that leads you very definitely away from bonds and towards stocks in your 401k plan. What will that pay off in the long run?
I think a lot of investment advisors recommend that as people get into their 70s or 80s, they ease out of the stock market and those risks. Do you disagree with that?
Well, it depends. If you're tight on resources and you're very anxious about market changes, maybe in someone individual's case, that ought to be considered really seriously. If, on the other hand, you happen to be affluent, and many investors are affluent, they have an opportunity to think in a different way. For an example, I've been lucky in my life, and so I happen to be reasonably well off, and I've got nice savings. I'm thinking of those savings and investing them partly for my wife to be sure she's secure in her financial situation, but primarily, candidly, for my grandsons and granddaughters because my children are all squared away for their lifetime. I'd be glad to do something for them, but I really care about the grandchildren and their average age is 17. So they've got enormous benefit of a lot of time. And if I'm investing for them, that takes you towards an equity investment portfolio. So I'm 100% in equities, even though I'm 88 years old and all the conventional wisdom, which is so often dead wrong, in this case, for me, would be dead wrong.
There's a multitude of retirement strategies once you actually do get into retirement, how much money you need to withdraw. For example, there is a 4% rule of taking out 4% of your assets each year. What is your approach to withdrawing from a nest egg to make sure you don't run out of money?
It's a little bit sophisticated, but not very. Nobel Prize winner James Tobin, very careful with numbers, created a fabulous concept of a spending rule that smooths the asset values base for calculating your spending rule over time. Jim came up with a concept that is being applied by most of the leading universities now on their endowment fund, and that can be simplified and adapted by anybody who would like to try it. And that is to take a 10-year average of asset values and use that as the base to determine how much you will spend. And that allows you usually to spend something like, if you believe markets are going to return roughly 7%, that inflation is going to be roughly 2%, which may be a little bit too optimistic. But that gives you a capacity to draw down 5% without any change in the value of the portfolio. If you want to pass it on to your family, descendants, fine. If, on the other hand, you don't have any responsibility in that direction, you can increase the spending rate from 5% to 6, 7, even 8%. And for individuals, that's an enormous liberation and increase in their freedom to live the kind of life they want to live. All of us can multiply and divide by 10. It's really easy, and it takes maybe a half an hour the first time you do it. Only takes 5 minutes after that each year. And in my view, that gives you a really nice way of calculating how much you can take and being realistic about how much it really is.
You close the book with advice on creating a personal investment plan. Can you just talk about that and why it's important to formally do that, actually have a plan?
If you don't have a plan, you are taking the largest risk you can possibly take from an investment or financial point of view. And that will come slamming up against your life experiences in all too many cases. So I really am quite a fan for figuring out what you're trying to accomplish, writing it down, sharing it with your spouse. If you have grown children who are alert and interested, share with them to be sure it makes sense in terms of what are your values, what do you want to accomplish, what are your resources, and what do you want to avoid along the way. Once you get that plan, return to it once a year to be sure that it hasn't resulted in a change in your life. Don't do anything because of the market change. But if you have changed, God forbid you've gone through a divorce, or if you have more children than you expected, or something great happened to you and all of a sudden you've got, that's more in the way of resources, or sadly something negative happened to you and it's really drawn down your resources. Once a year to evaluate your situation and then go back to your plan and see, is there any place that I really ought to change this for the long term? And when I say long term, I'm talking about at least 10 years, hopefully 20 years, because that gets you away from the anxieties that all of us experience from what happened in the market in the last day or two, or what are the threats that we hear about going on internationally or technology changing. On average, over time, the world keeps advancing, and it is very important for us not to get too excited about day-to-day activities because we're talking about long-term because it's your lifetime.
Just as a final thought, what is the most important investment advice you would offer to someone in their 20s or 30s?
You have the chance of a lifetime. All you have to do is save. If you will save and then put it into index funds, everything else will be taken care of. Compounding will work for you. The investing program will work for you. You'll have nothing you have to worry about. If you keep on saving, that'll make things better and better and better. You're creating for yourself in the future when you'll need it, the resources you'll be so glad you had. And if you have more resources than you need, then you can do things philanthropically or you can do things for your family. But that is great good news for any human being to be able to do nice things for nice people.
Investment expert Charles D. Ellis, his latest book is Rethinking Investing, A Very Short Guide to Very Long-Term Investing. Mr. Ellis, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Roy. I enjoyed it.
For InfoTrack, I'm Roy Mackey.
You're listening to InfoTrack, a production of Syndication Networks.